From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Last year, I warned against the expansion of violence and extremism. This year, too, I warned that if the right approach is not undertaken in dealing with the issue at hand, we get closer to a turbulent and tumultuous region with repercussions for the whole world. The right solution to this quandary comes from within the region and regionally provided solution with international support and not from outside of the region.
That was the President of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, at Thursday's session of the 69th UN General Assembly in New York. Rouhani was one of the many voices at the summit of world leaders to challenge the U.S. war on terror, as masking other, more sinister motives, saying that the U.S. approach would instead produce only more terrorism. We'll bring you more from the Iranian president's presentation to the General Assembly later in this newscast.
I'm here in Washington to ask for help in getting justice for my son in Missouri. Missouri has not showed us anything that we're looking for.
Wednesday saw a number of developments in the wake of last month's police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, as the families of some of the victims of police killings held a press conference in Washington, D.C.
Today, we come to demand justice. We come to demand fairness. And we come to demand a full and complete investigation by the United States Department of Justice into Michael Brown's death and Eric Garner's murder.
It was mere minutes after the press conference that word came out that Attorney General Eric Holder was resigning.
I come to this moment with very mixed emotions. Proud of what the men and women of the Department of Justice have accomplished over the last 6 years, and at the same time, very sad that I will not be a formal part of the great things that this department and this president will accomplish over the next two. I have loved the Department of Justice ever since as a young boy. I watched Robert Kennedy prove during the civil rights movement how the department can and must always be a force for that which is right.
We'll have more on that next week. The president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, was one of the assembled heads of states in New York to address Thursday's session of the 69th UN General Assembly. Rouhani was one of the many world leaders who challenged both the motives and efficacy of the U.S. war on terror. He also spoke about Iran's relations with its neighbors and with the U.S.
On behalf of the General Assembly, I have the honor to welcome to the United Nations His Excellency Hassan Rouhani, President of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and to invite him to address the Assembly.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, thanks be to God, the Lord of the two worlds, and may the prayers and peace be to Prophet Muhammad and his family and companions. Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, at the outset, I would like to extend my sincerest congratulations on your well-deserved election as the president of the 69th session of the General Assembly. I also express my appreciation to His Excellency Mr. Ban Ki-moon for all his efforts. It is my genuine hope that this year's session of the General Assembly brings the world in its current critical situation a step closer to security and tranquility of human beings, which is, of course, a fundamental goal of the United Nations. Mr. President, I am coming from a region of the world whose many parts are currently burning in the fire of extremism and radicalism. To the east and west of my country, extremists threaten our neighbors, resort to violence, and shed blood. They, of course, do not speak a single language. They are not of a single skin color. and not of a single nationality. They have come to the Middle East from around the world. They do, however, have a single ideology, violence and extremism. They also have a single goal, the destruction of civilization, giving rise to Islamophobia and creating a fertile ground for further intervention of foreign forces in our region. I deeply regret to say that terrorism has become globalized from New York to Mosul, from Damascus to Baghdad, from the easternmost to the westernmost parts of the world, from Al-Qaeda to Daesh. The extremists of the world have found each other and have put out the call. Extremists of the world, unite. But are we united against the extremists? Extremism is not a regional issue that only the nations of our region have to grapple with. Extremism is a global issue. Certain states have helped in creating it and are now failing to withstand it. Currently, our peoples are paying the price. Today's anti-Westernism is the offspring of yesterday's colonialism. Today's anti-Westernism is a reaction to yesterday's racism. Certain intelligence agencies have put blades in the hands of madmen who now spare no one. All those who have played a role in founding and supporting these terror groups must acknowledge their errors, which have led to extremism. They need to apologize not only to the past generations, but also to the next generation. To fight the underlying causes of terrorism, one must identify its roots and dry its source fountains. Terrorism germinates in poverty, unemployment, discrimination, humiliation, and injustice. And it grows in the culture of violence. To uproot extremism, we must spread justice and development and disallow the distortion of divine teachings to justify brutality and cruelty. The pain is made greater when these terrorists spill blood in the name of religion and behead in the name of Islam. They seek to keep hidden this incontrovertible truth of history, that on the basis of the teachings of all divine prophets, from Abraham to Moses, from Jesus to Muhammad, peace be upon him, taking the life of a single innocent human is akin to killing the whole humanity. I am astonished that these murderous groups call themselves Islamic. What is more astonishing is that the Western media, in line with them, repeats this false claim, which provokes the hatred of all Muslims. Muslim people who every day recall their God as merciful and compassionate and have learned lessons of kindness and empathy from their prophet's teachings see this defamation as a part of an Islamophobic project. The strategic blunders of the West in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Caucasus have turned these parts of the world into a haven for terrorists and extremists. Military aggression against Afghanistan and Iraq and improper interference in the developments in Syria are clear examples of this erroneous strategic approach in the Middle East. As non-peaceful approach, aggression and occupation target the lives and livelihoods of ordinary people, they result in different adverse psychological and behavioral consequences that are today manifested in the form of violence and murder in the Middle East and North Africa, even attracting some citizens from other parts of the world. Violence is currently being spread to other parts of the world like a contagious disease. We have always believed that democracy cannot be transplanted from abroad. Democracy is the product of growth and development, not war and aggression. Democracy is not an export product that can be commercially imported from the West to the East. In an underdeveloped society, imported democracy leads only to a weak and vulnerable government, which, when commanding generals step into a region, do not expect diplomats to greet them warmly. When war begins, diplomacy tends to end. When sanctions set in, deep hatred for those imposing them also begins. When the atmosphere of the Middle East is securitized, the answer will be of the same nature as well. The interests of the Western countries in our region are tied to the recognition of beliefs and the desires of the people for democratic governance in the region. Our region expects the experience of the creation of Al-Qaeda. The Taliban and modern extremist groups have demonstrated that no one can use extremist groups to counter an opposing state and remain impervious to the consequences of rising extremism. The repetition of these mistakes, despite many costly experiences, is perplexing. Let's recall that Iran had invited everyone to dialogue before the criminal act of September 11th and also called for a world against violence and extremism before the outbreak of the current violent atrocities. Perhaps in the past year, few people could forecast the fire that would rage today. But now, uninhibited violence and extremism presents an imminent threat to the world. It is self-evident that without an accurate understanding of how the current condition came about, we will not be able to find the right solutions. Today, again, I shall warn against the spread of extremism and the danger posed by the inadequate understanding and incorrect approach to this phenomenon. The Middle East longs for development and is weary of war. It is the natural right of the peoples of the fertile lands of the Middle East to live in peace and prosperity. In the past, colonialism denied them this right, and today the shadow of war and violence threatens their security. There are moderate politicians and elites in our region who enjoy the confidence of their peoples. They are neither anti-Western nor pro-Western. While aware of the role of colonialism in the backwardness of their nations, they are not neglectful of the role of their nations in reaching the development they seek. They do not absolve the West from its misdeeds, but are also aware of their own failings. These leaders can take a position of active leadership by attracting the confidence of the people in their societies and establish the strongest national and international coalitions against violence. The voices of these leaders are the true voices of moderation in the Islamic world. The familiar sound of an Afghan tired of war, an Iraqi victim of extremism, a Syrian fearful of terrorism, and a Lebanese worried about violence and sectarianism. I believe if countries claiming leadership of the coalition do so to continue their hegemony in the region, they would be making a strategic mistake. Obviously, since the pain is better known by the countries in the region, better they can form a coalition and accept to shoulder the responsibility of leadership to counter violence and terrorism. And if other nations wish to take action against terrorism, they must come to their support. I warn that if we do not muster all of our strengths against extremism and violence, and fail to entrust the job to the people in the region who can deliver tomorrow, this world will not be safe for anyone. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, last year I tried to fulfill the role of my country in the realization of peace at both the regional and international levels by putting forward a proposal of a world against violence and extremism, which was met with general support. In the tumultuous and chaotic region of the Middle East, Iran is one of the most tranquil, secure, and stable nations. All the nations of the region have to keep in mind that we are in the same boat. Thus, we need broad cooperation with regard to social and political, as well as security and defense issues, with a view towards reaching common and durable understandings. Had we had greater cooperation and coordination in the Middle East, thousands of innocent Palestinians in Gaza would not have fallen victim to the Zionist regime's aggressions. We in the Islamic Republic of Iran consider interaction and confidence building among states of the region as fundamentally essential for conflict resolution. We support any measure to promote cooperation between Islamic nations to combat extremism, threats, and aggression. And in connection with this, we are prepared to play our permanent, constructive, and positive role. Mr. President, the oppressive sanctions against Iran go on, in continuation of a strategic mistake made against a moderate and independent nation under the current sensitive conditions in our region. During the last year, we have engaged in the most transparent dialogue to build confidence regarding Iran's peaceful nuclear program. We place serious and honest negotiations on the agenda, not in result of sanctions or threats, but rather because of the will of our people. We are of the view that the nuclear issue could only be resolved through negotiations, and those who may think of any other solution would be committing a grave mistake in doing so. Any delay in arriving at a final agreement not only raises the costs, not only at our expense, but also at the expense of the economy and trade of other parties, as well as the development and security prospects of our region. No one should doubt that compromise and agreement on this issue is in the best interests of everyone, especially that of the nations of the region. The nuclear negotiations between Iran and the 5+1 have continued during the past year and the past few months with seriousness and optimism on both sides. According to all international observers, the Islamic Republic of Iran has carried out its commitments in good faith. Although some of the observations and actions of our counterparts have created certain doubts regarding their determination and realism, we hope that the current negotiations will lead to a final accord in the short amount of time that we have left. We are committed to continue our peaceful nuclear program, including enrichment, and to enjoy our full nuclear rights on Iranian soil within the framework of international law. We are determined to continue negotiations with our interlocutors in earnest and good faith, based on mutual respect and confidence, the removal of concerns for both sides, as well as equal footing and recognized international norms and principles. I do believe mutual adherence to the strict implementation of commitments and obligations and avoidance of excessive demands in the negotiations by our counterparts is the prerequisite for the success of the negotiations. A final accord regarding Iran's peaceful nuclear program can serve as the beginning of multilateral collaboration aimed at promoting security, peace and development in our region and beyond. The people of Iran who have been subjected to pressures, especially in the past 3 years, as a result of continued sanctions, cannot place trust in any security cooperation between their governments with those who have imposed sanctions and created obstacles in the way of satisfying even their primary needs, such as food and medicine. These sanctions will create additional impediments in the way to the future long-term cooperation. The people of Iran are devoted to certain principles and values at the apex of which are independence, development, and national pride. If this obvious national fact is not understood by our negotiating partners and they commit grievous miscalculations in the process, a historic and exceptional opportunity will be lost. As you know, during the ongoing nuclear negotiations in this year, the Iranian government took some initiative and created favorable conditions, which resulted in a new phase in the Geneva Joint Plan of Action. We are determined to continue our confidence-building approach and our transparency in this process. If our interlocutors are also equally motivated and flexible, and we can overcome the problem and reach a long-standing agreement within the time remaining, then an entirely different environment will emerge for cooperation at the regional and international levels, allowing for greater focus on some very important regional issues, such as combating violence and extremism in the region. Arriving at a final comprehensive nuclear agreement with Iran will be a historic opportunity for the West to show that it does not oppose the advancement and development of others and does not discriminate when it comes to adhering to international rules and regulations. This agreement can carry a global message of peace, security, indicating that the only way to attain conflict resolution is through negotiations and respect, and not through conflict and sanctions. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, last year, the great nation of Iran broadly participated in the calm and impressive presidential elections and endorsed the discourse of foresight, hope, and prudent moderation. Thereafter, they supported their elected government in its efforts in building the country, while some of the countries around Iran have fallen prey to war and turmoil. Iran remains secure, stable, and calm. My government's principled policy is to work towards constructive interactions with our neighbors on the basis of mutual respect and with emphasis on common interests. The notion that Iran seeks to control other Muslim countries in the region is a myth fanned in the recent years in the context of an Iranophobic project. Those who make these claims need imaginary enemies to sustain tensions and sow division and conflict, thus, in this way, pushing for the redeployment of national resources away from development. We work towards putting an end to the delusional Iranophobia, setting the stage for building strategic partnerships with our neighbors. In conclusion, last year I warned against the expansion of violence and extremism. This year, too, I warn that if the right approach is not undertaken in dealing with the issue at hand, we get closer to a turbulent and tumultuous region with repercussions for the whole world. The right solution to this quandary comes from within the region and regionally provided solution with international support and not from outside of the region. God the Almighty has promised in the Holy Quran to those who have believed and done righteous deeds that He will surely grant them succession to authority upon the earth and that their fears will turn into peace and security. It is my sincerest hope that our generation endeavors to leave a more secure and developed earth as its legacy for the next generation. I wish you all a great deal of success and many blessings. Thank you.
The UN General Assembly members debate will continue until next Tuesday, and we will bring you more of its highlights over the coming days. Up next, Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford takes a look at what's left of the Congressional Black Caucus.
The ever-shrinking left wing of the Congressional Black Caucus crumbled last week, an early casualty of the new phase of President Obama's three-year war for regime change in Syria. The Congressional Progressive Caucus, to which 24 of the black lawmakers belong, also failed to rally against a Democratic president's war plans. The lopsided House vote was not on whether to authorize Obama to launch attacks against targets in Syria. The White House claims the president is acting within his powers as commander-in-chief and needs no okay from the Congress. Instead, the administration sought a general demonstration of approval for Obama's scheme to train and arm so-called moderate Syrian rebels. A vote on the $500 million price tag comes later, after the November elections. In essence, Obama was asking for a do-over to fix his previous policies in Syria. The United States and its Arab, Turkish, European, and reportedly Israeli allies have in fact been arming and training rebels to bring down the government of President Bashar Assad since at least 2011. They have failed, despite having spent mountains of money to subsidize a kaleidoscope of armed groups, each vying for Islamic fundamentalist authenticity and the privilege to slaughter Shiites, Christians, secularists, apostate Sunni Muslims, and backsliders of all kinds. It also turned out, to the administration's apparent surprise, that these jihadists don't see themselves as mere foot soldiers under an American chain of command. In fact, the best fighters think of the United States as the great Satan, an opinion widely shared in that part of the world. With the rise of the head-chopping champions of ISIS, Obama had no choice but to ask Congress to give him another chance to scour the region in search of that most elusive of men, the moderate Syrian rebel, and turn him into a killing machine that can defeat both the Syrian government and ISIS. Back in 2006, after 3 years of failure in Iraq, George W. Bush agreed to a timetable for withdrawal from that country. He had little choice because the Congress was in no mood to continue his war. But last week, President Obama, by a vote of 273 to 156, was allowed a second throw of the dice in what may turn out to be an even larger war in Syria and Iraq, and who knows where else. The reason that Obama's wars have such longer shelf life is that Democrats will not oppose him, including such luminaries of the Black Caucus left wing as John Conyers and Maxine Waters, who are among the 23 black members who gave the president a blank check last week. Barbara Lee, the California congresswoman, who joined 16 other black lawmakers in opposing Obama's new and improved war in the Middle East, said on the House floor, "The consequences of this vote, whether it's written in the amendment or not, will be a further expansion of a war currently taking place and our further involvement in a sectarian war." There is also another consequence, the total discrediting of a majority of the Congressional Black Caucus, who have abandoned the historical black consensus on social justice and peace. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.